Hello, dear humans. Welcome to another episode of Emerge. On this episode, we begin the three-episode arc with Bonita Roy on the topic of source code analysis applied to the concepts of power, trust, and collective action. And so this analysis, this practice, this form of relating to conceptuality carries with it a deep commitment to unpack hidden assumptions around concepts that dominate our life and our language. And this is all for the sake of identifying a way of conceiving of things like power that we can then build a new and more useful conversation around. And I gotta say, I found this conversation and the other two that we recorded to be deeply useful to me in my own life. And I think it's the case, and once you hear the conversation and hopefully start playing with it in your own life, this different idea of power, you start to see the way in which these concepts and our confusion about them influence the ways that we talk to each other and think about politics and make decisions, and that indeed confusion around these ideas has, kind of emerges as confusion in political movements, in relationships to collectives of all kinds. And so I just can't say enough how useful this method is. And I look forward to continuing to explore it. I look forward to sharing the other two conversations in the series. And please let me know, let us know if this is useful to you, if you'd like to see more of this kind of approach. You know, I think we also demonstrated this kind of approach to a certain degree in the conversation with Bonita and Jordan Greenhall and I. So you can also look to that to get another sense of the flavor for this method of discourse that Bonita Roy calls source code analysis. Okay, so with that as the introduction, please enjoy this episode of Emerge.
But before we get started, I'd like to invite you into a relationship of support with this project. This episode arc with Bonita Roy will be the kind of finale, the grand finale of season two of Emerge. And I'm really excited and really glad with how this project is going. And I'd like to spend more time. I'd like to give it more care. I'd like to kind of nurture the soil and the network that's been growing around this project. I think that there's a lot of fertility here. I think actually the conversations that I'm having and the people that are being drawn to this project are, I mean, for me at least, it's extremely energizing and beautiful and exciting and promising and hopeful, actually. You know, if you have that sense of this being exciting and hopeful and promising and interesting, I encourage you to consider supporting the show financially. And you can do that if you check the show notes or if you go to anchor.fm/emerge. I think Sam Harris has a really good explainer on why it's important that that shows become supported by audience members instead of by advertising or something else. And I really agree with that. I would really love to live in a world where at least a part of my income comes from this project, such that I can really dedicate myself in a way that's, you know, uncensored, uncontrolled, and feels kind of honoring of the importance and significance of this subject matter. And so if you feel inspired, if you feel moved, please consider giving a little bit to the show. And I really appreciate those of you who have already given. And I want to, in particular, appreciate Anthony Morley for choosing to become a supporter of the show since the last episode was shared. And yeah, thank you, everybody who has given a little bit. It really makes a difference to me, and I appreciate it deeply. Thank you.
You know, as we discussed, I kind of open it up and just say, like, you know, after our last conversation, number one, a lot of people reached out to me and told me that, you know, they listened to our conversation twice. They took notes on it, that it really, I think, was clarifying for them in how they approach and think about just the world at this crazy time. And so this now conversation that we're in at this moment sort of emerged out of Bonita and I continuing to be in touch and just sort of, like, you know, syncing up and vibing on the same kind of riding on the same rainbow, maybe, about how we might work with complex systems. Yes, but also have conversations about complexity that are actually useful. And as Bonita, as you say in the video you sent me, you know, that avoid certain traps that our culture seems to be disposed to fall into these days, traps like postmodern structuralism, reductive empiricism, or, as we discussed a lot in the last show, vertical moves into meta theory. And if you spend enough time in any of these circles, you will start to see that these are indeed traps. And so the question then becomes, like, how do we use our minds to approach these problems in a way that actually leads us somewhere useful, or at least not, like, obviously harmful to the process of trying to create a more beautiful future. And so with that as kind of the setup, Bonita, welcome. Thank you so much for coming back on Emerge.
Yeah. So what stood out for me in the intro was useful. We're not necessarily trying to create a valid theories. That would be in the direction toward those moves, right? Mm. But so then what do we mean by useful? And that actually touched on how I would like to start the conversation. And I had a little example in my mind, so I'll just frame that. So useful means, after we finish our discussion today, what kind of effect would we like that to have on the audience? What kind of impact could these types of approaches have? And so, as an example, I don't know if you've ever read David Graeber's book, Debt, 5,000 Years. But in that book, he shows that our current monetary system, whenever you print money, it's actually debt, right? Because whenever the central bank prints a dollar, it's owed back to the central bank with interest. Mm. So this is one of these ways of really unpacking what money is. So once you know that, there are certain ramifications of truly understanding that. So, for example, if you have a growing economy and you're printing more money, you're actually, the economy is going into exponential debt. If the economy is growing exponentially, there's no way out of that fundamental way that money operates or functions in a state-backed currency that is run by central banks and not by the nation state. So,
yes.
What do you do then with that? Once you understand that, and hopefully we'll get to a similar understanding of power, it should have results. And so with money, you can do one or two things. Once you know that there are unavoidable properties, you could either choose not to, you know, first of all, you don't make complex arguments about why there's a $1 trillion debt and what you should do with your money that are just a distraction from the truth, right? So it doesn't. But the other thing is you can say, given that is the constant reality, how do we hack that? So that's a disruptive way to look at it. Given that money is always debt, how do we hack that as a constant reality? So that's what I think would be kind of describe what is useful in this approach of understanding some of these things in this kind of way that we'll get to.
It reminds me of this quote I heard recently, that there's nothing more practical than a good theory, right? Which I think, if anything, should be evident of how many bad theories there are in the world, because there's so much that you can learn that isn't actually useful when it comes to solving the real problems of our era. And so hopefully here we'll kind of both set up a frame of analysis that you call source code analysis, that is generally useful for talking about complex issues. And then we'll do the specific source code analysis in this episode of the, what would you call it? Like the kind of idea of power?
Yeah, just the idea of power, broadly defined. And
Great. So let's start by just saying, like, well, what is a source code analysis?
It's kind of a fancy name, and the way I sent it to you in that interview is very formulaic. It doesn't actually come out of a process that's that formulaic, but it comes out of a commitment to unpack hidden assumptions in the discourse around anything. So if you start, for example, with a mess, let's say, you know, we can imagine the mess of Jordan Peterson talking to Ben Shapiro and Ezra Klein on identity politics. And, you know, we say, oh, my God, this is a mess. How can we disentangle some of the semiotics or some of the signifiers that are going on in here? And so in this case, I think, you know, we're talking, we want to disentangle what people, how they're relating to the word power. And so there's power in the patriarchy, there's power in identity politics, there's power in all this conversation. And perhaps we could say, there's other things in that, but I think that power is a pretty much a big one, like the dominance hierarchy and who has power in Black Lives Matter. These whole conversations, I think, in general, are around power. So source code analysis is a way to identify. It has certain steps. So what we want to get to is identify a unformulated or unelaborated definition of power, what I call a conceptual prime, that then we can build a new conversation around that already doesn't have triggers and biases and sliding context. So that's what we would try to do.
Cool. And so can you maybe just say a little bit about that last piece? And I think it has to do with the traps, because I think, you know, so we identified some traps. You also identified something in your video called the naturalistic fallacy, which I think just kind of understanding how it is that source code analysis might help us avoid the naturalistic fallacy as well as other common traps, just to give us some context before we start unpacking it in the context of power.
Right. So So there's a lot of things in source code analysis that we can say it's not this, it's not postmodern structuralism, and we also have to avoid certain moves that we're tempted to do in doing this kind of analysis. And what is a naturalistic fallacy? So the naturalistic fallacy says that you can't go into nature and see what nature's doing and then say, well, then the definition of power is what we see in nature, because you're actually, what you see in nature is already filtered or shaped by a theory of what's going on. And so, for example, for years, they had a theory of herd dynamics in horses. And then they did a study, I think over 40 years of wild horses in France. And they showed, with your eyes wide open, it wasn't a stallion-driven dominance hierarchy. There's many, many more complex power negotiations going on, and some of them are really subtle, and there's always exceptions that prove the rules, and this rich tapestry of embodied beings and how they related with each other in some of those, and organize, the way they organized was fluid. So under certain conditions, it looked more like a patriarchy. Under certain conditions, it looked more like a matriarchy. Under certain conditions, it looked more like Generation X coming up, you know, and that. So, but for years, they just looked and said, well, patriarchy, the dominance hierarchy is even expressed in herds in nature. You see, so we have to be very careful that we don't try to prove that the dominance hierarchy is functionally essential to all you know, human animals, because the lobster presents his claw in a certain ritualistic communication. You know, this is called the naturalistic fallacy.
Yeah, interesting. And so it functionally seems similar to a form of reductionism, except it's almost like a twice confused reductionism, because first we reduce our power structures to like hierarchy, and then we look at, like, say, lobsters and say, oh, there's a mirror there, and so therefore what we're doing is natural, but really we're just getting lost, it seems, in a kind of like a trap or something.
Exactly. And so we can make this pretty clear right now with this, the next move, and that is to understand that when we look at, I don't want to talk about lobsters because I don't know that much about lobsters, but I've worked with horses for a long time. When we look at nature, we are seeing patterns. And we are seeing certain patterns and not others, and we are trying to explain those patterns. And so what we really want to do in this source code analysis is not argue about the patterns, if the patterns are real or not, or are there other patterns, but what are the protocols and the context and the contingencies that create the patterns we see? Right. So, and obviously, so that's another thing. We want to make sure that we are not, if I'm saying, oh, I see a patriarchy in this herd, and another person saying, I see a matriarchy in this, then we're arguing at the level of patterns. So if we're both being honest, if we're both being honest and we're generous, and the other person saying, no, this is how I relate to it, then there must be protocols that source both those patterns. And that's what we're looking for, protocols and contingencies. We want to understand it at that level.
Right on. Yeah. And so again, circling back, that would make a conversation actually useful, because then we'd actually be in traction with the protocols, as you call them, that give rise to these emergent patterns that often we don't like, for instance, patriarchy, which is a current kind of whipping boy of a big segment of our culture.
Correct.
Great. Okay. So I feel like that's pretty well understood as a context. And just again, to take a step back and just say the kind of reason we're now going to be going into power in particular is so that we can kind of demonstrate what it might be like to talk about complex and important issues in a way that might actually make a difference, right? So so with that as the kind of context, what what is power?
So I'm not saying this is the only conceptual prime you can make out of power or native definition.
Yes.
I have been using it and it seems to be very useful. Mm. And so, you know, if it's useful across many broad categories and it kind of clears the field, then maybe it's a powerful conceptual prime. So I know I was always laughing in that video I sent you because I kept on having to use the word, oh, and it's powerful, and it kind of was recursive there. So just going right at it, my definition of my conceptual prime of power is that it's who gets to move who. And this is foundational to whether we're talking about non-living things or other living beings or complex systems. Like if I say a hurricane is powerful, it gets to move my whole house or it gets to move me underground. So we're really trying to look at power as that, who gets to move who. Now, in these larger discourses, in these social discourses, we are sometimes talking about, physical force, you know, like if I'm in a boxing ring, the powers who gets to, or a wrestling match, move who. And certainly I want to acknowledge that in some cases, this kind of discourse devolves down to a very raw definition of who gets to move who, which we call violence or force. Mm. But in general, in these more complex, we're talking about who gets to move who through social, emotional, biopsychological protocols. Mm. And this, once we look at this very carefully, then we see that we are not very skillful at preserving our own power or working with power dynamics. And I give you, so who gets to move who? Just give you one example. If I'm a young person in college and I go to a party and this great looking guy kind of bumps into me or something, and I turn around and my body is moved, you know, I'm just kind of out of control and I'm getting a crush and I'm blabbering like an idiot and stuff, I will feel that person has power over me. Because just by being that person, just by the way it's set up, my needs and wants, what's ever happening, they are moving me. They are moving me. So a parent has the same kind of power over a child, even as a child becomes an adult, right? Who gets to move who? Put someone off balance, move them off balance. And if I'm a kind of a radical feminist, I might actually see this innocent person was just standing there. I might actually perceive that as being some kind of microaggression or something, because I truly feel a power asymmetry because I'm being moved and the other person is not. So this is how it works. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And so in the case where they're right, like that person is exerting power over them, whether or not intention really arises anywhere in either party's experience.
Correct. The felt sense of power asymmetry is there.
Right.
That's the phenomenon. That's the felt. Right. That's real. But, yeah. Right.
Well, and that just gets to like, I have traumatic memories of like Occupy Wall Street, where people would try to kind of pretend as if there was intention present when there wasn't, and how quickly that would devolve the conversations. Whereas if I can imagine having a conversation where if people were taking responsibility for their own subjectivity and saying something like, well, I noticed that when you entered the room, I suddenly felt scared, or I don't know exactly how it would play out, but it seems to suck some of the propensity for trigger and meaningless conversation out of the equation.
Yes, a lot of the conversation we're going to have here is that in the postmodern conversation, how do I increase my power, keep my balance? Well, the postmodern, the move is, I need to overpower you. I need more skills so that campus police keeps people like you away from me or something like that. So that's to increase the external conditioners. But what is seldom the case is people realize what's happening in me that is disempowering me. Why am I always off balance? What is my need here? What is my want? What is my weakness in this situation? So I learned this from training horses, and I trained stallions, and the stallions, just if you're looking at the stallion and you're a little skillless or you're new at this, you definitely feel overpowered, right? Physically overpowered. And then if you actually have a little dog and the dog is also got a lot of energy and running around and doing the exact same thing the horse is, you think it's cute. And the temptation with the stallion is to think he's mean or aggressive or violent. And in this case, it's just because size matters. So you have to, so this is the way we can talk about this, that we want to be very, very clear about why the power asymmetry is being felt in the way it is, and where are we going to move when we are being moved?
Yeah. And so you have this really nice equation that's coming more clear to me why this is so important, but of skills and resources divided by needs and wants, which I, as a person who has spent some time in a monastery, I really appreciate it, because what becomes clear is that you become very powerful if you need or want nothing.
Exactly. So this is, maybe it'll be intuitive to the audience as I could talk about this all day, but if you understand it, you get a very strong intuitive hit. And great literature is filled with this, the woman that wants the man and the man doesn't care, that her want or vice versa just fuels that power over them. And you can go a long way with this. It's very, very important in business. I used to tell the salespeople who were designing huge landscape construction projects for the rich and famous, they'd come in, they would have an opportunity to build Shangri-La and 75 acres of beautiful land. And I'd say, you're in trouble. You want this more than your client does. So you have no negotiating power. This is, when someone like me with this definition of power sees people demonstrating on Wall Street for the government to give them things, it's just ludicrous. I want you to give me something, it's in the hopes of getting a chunk of power, they just disempower themselves over and over and over again. And Jordan Peterson, I just say Jordan Peterson has that same problem. He has an interesting relationship with what he calls crazy women. I just don't know how to convince them of anything. And he disempowers himself in the fact that he needs so much to convince crazy people of his position. It doesn't really make any sense when you look at it that way.
Right. Well, this is still a little unclear to me, and maybe we can unpack this. It'll be useful to unpack this, but looking at a phenomenon like Occupy Wall Street, you said that, having this equation of skills and resources over needs and want, and the idea of power is who gets to move who, kind of reveals this underlying disempowerment of that movement or that phenomenon. And I guess can you explain that in a different way? Because it's still not completely clear how this equation affords that insight.
Okay. So we're going to talk about a dyad, just two people, because it's easier to talk about, but it's never about just two people. but or two beings, or, you know, works with people and animals. Mm-hmm. When they meet, each one has certain skills and resources and needs and wants. So I say their absolute power is skills and resources divided by their needs and wants. And so because those aren't ever exactly the same, when people meet over a theme or any kind of collective action, there's a power asymmetry. So let's say I want to move the couch, but my skills are such I can't move it by myself. But my needs are over the top because my mother's coming over and she always yells at me. And then my husband, you know, he has the skills to move the couch, but he doesn't have a lot of needs and wants. In fact, they may be negative needs and wants. And so this is already a negotiation where people hold different kinds of powers. But then, you know, I could say, well, he needs and wants me to be happy, so I can play a certain role that will tug on his psychological strings. And so this is what's called complex processes of human relating. They're complex negotiations across asymmetric power dynamics that create the patterns in organizations, in families, in society that we see. And the more mindful we can be, what do I bring to this interaction? What are my needs and wants? What are my skills and resources? And there's a little more to that. But this asymmetry is always in constant, very subtle negotiation. And so let's just stop there. There's a part two to that, but maybe we can stop there for right now.
Yeah. Well, just a couple things come to mind. One is it now is clear to me, you know, how there was a way in which at least a big part of Occupy, for example, were coming with a lot of needs and a lot of wants and very few skills and resources, and I think one of the effects of that, though, was actually that imbalance was felt. And for me and for many other people who were there, it became a tremendous learning experience because there was a lot of skills and resources kind of, it was seen that was needed, you know, given the level of needs for a more beautiful future. And so that's one piece. And the other piece is just to sort of acknowledge, because I've gotten this feedback, I think, about a couple of episodes, but these kinds of analytical lenses are very beautiful and powerful. But obviously, you should be able to put them down. Like, we're not talking about always looking at your relationship with your significant other as if it is, you know, in terms of these power equations. That would be very sad and very, inhuman. Yes. And so just to say that and make that clear before we roll on to the next part.
Yeah. This timeout is to kind of reboot the system so you can have better discussions, which operate like just human, intimate human discussions. You know, the analysis is to deconstruct the habits of the old way of talking. And to be more sensitive to, you know, now that we've, where can I start? Sometimes we don't even know how to start after we've seen the problems. The idea is not to, and none of this is because it lives truly in the space of real complexity. None of this is gameable. Because there's no actual cause and effect. It's holistically contingent. So that's another thing to be aware of. It's more like mindfulness training to be aware that these subtle things are going on. And you know, to really be mindful about what your needs and wants are and how that is presenting and unfolding in your reality by holding on to those.
Yeah, totally. And that is just so beautiful. I mean, it reminds me of, like, in meditation, I remember sitting a retreat and the kind of big insight was, you know, don't try to change reality, but instead try to see reality so clearly that it changes itself. And there's a kind of similar movement that I hear you speaking about that can maybe happen in the social space, in the power relations space, where it's less about a specific move and more about unlocking new ways of being and seeing through our awareness or through our paying attention to certain dynamics.
Correct. It's like that, how I started. It's like, finally you see, boom, I see that money is debt. So everything that I tried to do was in the wrong direction. Now coming up with how to move off of that direction is interesting, creative work. Hmm. But you need to see that you've been, you know, it's kind of like, oh, I know it. I had a metaphor. I woke up with this metaphor. It's like the hamster on the wheel trying to get somewhere. Mm. And then one day, boom, he sees it's a wheel. Mm. Well, that's just the starting point, right?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like that. You see that, oh, power works this way. No matter how much I do in that old way, I'm not moving toward the more beautiful world or toward the solution of something I am interested in or something. And, you know, you may discover that you have needs and wants that are not helpful, but you may also discover that in there is the core need or the core want. Mm. And then you can examine that more closely, more mindfully. Mm. And that will bring us to part two. But let's just keep going here.
Right. So where should we go next in terms of understanding and kind of making use of this power equation or so? So there's the power equation, and then there's the protocols.
Let's back up.
Okay, great.
I'm remembering. So we just did a little bit of source code analysis, kind of give a feeling of what an end product might look like. One of the things that we need to understand in this kind of work is that basically there's power that we talked about. We talked about the felt sense of power is the sense that I'm being moved, either physically or bio, psycho, sociological. Then the other thing, we're going to back up to a larger level. And we talked about that power is patterns we see that emerge from protocols. And I call that the power matrix, just to make sure that we're talking about the patterns we see and not the lived experience, which is this felt sense. Mm. Now, what's important to understand is that, remember last time we were talking about a lot of the discourses on aboutism? Yes. Aboutism is usually discourse around the patterns we see that emerge at a certain level. The complexity of the interactions create patterns. Mm. And what's important is that to have a lens from complexities, you cannot operate on the system at the level of emergence, right? So I can't operate on the, because the at the level of the emergent pattern, that is just the pattern. Mm. You have to operate on the protocols that are producing those patterns. So it's a little stickier than that, because if you do talk about the emergent patterns, that changes the protocols beneath them. But in general, you have a whole lot more impact if you try to operate at the protocols from which those patterns emerge.
Just to spend maybe a little bit of time here, because I think this is such a vital clarification. This is similar to what we were talking about earlier, where with Daniel Schmachtenberger's idea of the generator function, and and maybe you can kind of just parallax those or kind of compare those, just to give us more clarity about why this is so significant.
Yeah, so it's the same move. He's Schmattenberg is very good at talking about these very large patterns of resource depletion and how the economy works toward negative impact on the environment. And he lays it all out, and then you'll hear him say something and to look at the generator function that has created this system, right? So he uses that term, and I can't remember any specifics. I've watched a lot of his stuff, but he's looking for the generator function, and we want to change the generator function. Sometimes it just requires a tweak, right? I mean, but finding the tweak is not an easy task. So that's another, I say, protocol generator function is similar. Perhaps he'll listen to this and make it an important
distinction. Thank you. And so just to have that in mind, you know, you can't act on the level of, say, climate change itself. That climate change doesn't exist except as this emergent property of the, you know, the running of perhaps multiple generator functions or certainly lots of different protocols, right? So that's how we might understand the significance of what you have kind of laid out around emergence in this case. Yeah,
perfect example.
Okay, so we've established that we're not talking about, for instance, patriarchy. We're talking about which you would call the power, a power matrix. Was that how you might refer to patriarchy?
Is it, yes,
a power matrix? Okay.
Yes. Or a pattern in the matrix.
Okay. A pattern in the matrix. Yeah. And so now I guess we're going to kind of zoom back. Or where do you want to go next? Where would be the right place to go next?
I'm not sure this bridges well, but I'll throw it out there and then maybe we can help if it doesn't make sense. So one of the things, I'm going to go back to two people come together and, you know, my story about the couch, and there's a negotiation going on because there's a power asymmetry. And the question is, so two things can happen. A certain attitude will seek to increase that asymmetry. And a certain attitude is interested in that, is curious about what happens if that asymmetry is decreased. And I'm not talking about disempowering people. Like, you have to be careful, because if I just give in and do everything, if I just capitulate and solve all your needs and wants, then the gradient is not necessarily going to decrease. It might actually flip. So we can ask ourselves, as a, see, it's a different question than saying equality or egalitarianism or equality of opportunity. So it's a different question. It's a more interesting question, because it doesn't necessarily say one is better than the other. It says there's two different outcomes. You get two different outcomes. So, for example, and I'll give an easy example. In business, conventional companies want to establish a strong asymmetry between themselves and their customers. Because then the customer pays more and they keep needing to buy new things. Now, recently in the disruptive economy, something interesting happens. The organization, the product or service, doesn't cater to the customer's needs. It displaces it. It either makes it go away or it gives the customer their own skills and resources. This is a disruptive economy. That this is happening in this day and age is fascinating because it's a different kind of move. It doesn't disempower the company and it doesn't disempower the customer. And it reminds me of Jordan Greenhalgh's anti-rivalrous behavior. The more you do this, the better it is for both sides of the equation.
It brings to mind the omni-win idea of Daniel Schmachtenberger as well. So again, just pointing out these these threads exactly. and parallel processes, but please continue.
Yeah, no, pointing out the threads and parallel processes is really important because it gives, when you look around and you see other people who kind of know each other because we watch things, but we come from completely different backgrounds and participate in the world in completely different ways, but you're getting to the same kind of thing. Mm. It gives you confidence that you're actually talking about reality. Yeah. You're not talking about your perception of reality, and something is coming forward. Mm. But I actually believe there's so there's something interested in this notion of the way we're learning how to negotiate asymmetries in a different direction, because if you believe in what is this book, The Zero Marginal Cost Society, Jeremy Rifkin sees that there's something breaking out. And of course, conventional organizations know that commodities go to zero and the cost of production goes to zero. There's actually something like this happening in economies today, this movement toward more symmetry between in complex processes of human relating called economies. Mm. So that's interesting. Something in that conversation is also in this conversation.
Mm. Okay. Well, so I'm like right on the edge of my kind of complexity and understanding. And I also want to notice that a lot of the way that this form of analysis seems to be impacting me is on in like a kind of embodied level. Like it seems like things all of a sudden become clear and then it just sort of recedes into the background. So there, it does seem to produce insights, at least in me, which is really fascinating that we could come up with a kind of linguistic strategy that could reliably produce insights about complex phenomena is like really captivating.
So this work is not for the faint of heart, and because what happens, I mean, I'm glad you said that, but what happens with most people is they'll get the insight and then the need to argue the position that they're kind of habituated with becomes, they're addicted to it. But he has more money than me. Oh, but. Mm-hmm. 1% of the people own all the money. But you see, so you get, it's really requires discipline because you get triggered into wanting to enter the old narrative, mm-hmm. but it takes a lot of time to let the insight open space for a new vision. And when you're talking about the kind of radical paradigm shift we need, those are the kinds of disciplines we need to practice. But you will feel the need, you know, people who are in the old discourse, to re-enter that, mm-hmm. and it's very mm-hmm. difficult.
Which is a form of power. Like we could actually leverage this model on that very movement, I imagine.
Okay, perfect insight. Which shows you that the media. And the constant cycle of all this discourse in the media depletes your power. Mm. It has power over you. You can't even create space to look at optional ways of looking at things. You're actually hyper-reactive. You know, this is disempowering. Mm.
This is maybe a bit of a question on the left field, but I think... I want to see what happens if we try to go in this direction, which is given this sort of understanding of power, and we talked a little bit about Occupy Wall Street, how would you, using this theory or this kind of analysis, imagine a movement to actually gather the power necessary to move the world in a more beautiful direction?
You know, it's interesting. I'm noticing that what we've been talking about has been also articulated in some ways by Jordan Greenhall and the notion of mm-hmm. sovereignty. And so, this notion of we want to move into a future that we aspire to. And this notion, but and so it requires something of us, and it requires us to make choices and to demonstrate behaviors that we are unfamiliar with and that will feel risky. I mean, I'll go there. People never like it when I go there, so I'll just go there. So I had a I was having one of these conversations with a group of people, and the topic was healthcare and how awful the U.S. does healthcare, and actually how awful Western science does healthcare. And it was going on and on and on. And then I said, well, how many people have health insurance? And they all raised their hands. So I said, perhaps we have the health insurance and healthcare system we have because we pay for it and we continue to utilize it. So at a certain point, it does, if you're very committed to a more beautiful world, you make personal choices that you find they will come with the taste of risk. However, if you start doing some of that, you realize how snookered you've been all along. Like, I don't have health insurance. I work with horses. I got my arm blown out by a young horse that was just kicking up in the pasture, and I wasn't paying attention. I had 102 stitches and x-rays, emergency room. And it costs like $1,900. And it's just, healthcare is such a ripoff. And so there's a lot of space to maneuver in the world in this new paradigm, but we don't seem to be able to make the choices and perform the behaviors in that direction. And if we can't do that, then it's not going to happen. Your parents, no one's going to do that for us.
Right. But the complication, or the part I'm curious about, is like, I know people, and I have done such risky behavior, to kind of the kind you talk about, but then it often is just one person or a couple of people or whatever. How do we, again, kind of build momentum of the collective towards a more sane direction? Well, laying aside a beautiful future, let's just aim for a sane present and near future for a little bit.
I mean, it's a big question. I think that I don't think we'll ever know how to do that. I think that we may succeed in doing that, or we may not, or we may fail. But I don't think it'll come from, at some point before it happens, we know how to do it. I know, it's one of those real answers. Because it's one of those, it's an emergent outcome of behaviors. So we may actually be doing that right now, or we may not. But it's not like standing back and knowing about it. It's about inspecting, trying to rid ourselves of malware or not profitable assumptions or just wrong assumptions, and trying to work in a new kind of clarity at all levels. Right. So that if you happen to be doing big systems thinking, then also at that level, someone's trying to work at a new clarity.
Yeah. One thing that comes into mind is it's fascinating how, for instance, the election of Donald Trump beforehand was inconceivable, and then afterwards was inevitable.
Yeah.
And I imagine
that's typical.
Yeah. I imagine the same kind of thing we might imagine for how we get to where we want to get. or that's what it brought to mind when you were speaking, is this kind of, yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, you might look back, and as we are saying already, that the election of Donald Trump was a pivot point, and it arose at the right time, and you can create a theory around why the human race emerged as it did or didn't or whatever, but that would be retrospective sense making. And in my opinion, with the techniques like this kind of analysis of power, if you pay attention to your lived experience very closely and you enact outcomes that are attending to those, then you will affect the future that you hope for. It's yeah. It's the paradox of being what Jean-Luc Nancy called singular plural, or singular plural beings.
Yes. Yeah, or what they call in the metamodern politics movement a divisual. They have that frame. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, some people are in roles that move mountains and have a larger sort of obvious impact. Other people are in roles that have more discourse impact. Other people are on the front lines of very small initiatives packed with a lot of meaning. All of these are part of the answer.
Beautiful. I feel like that's kind of, I mean, is there more that would be really useful to unpack now? I feel like we got to a really good place.
Yeah, I think we got to a really good place. And maybe we'll get some feedback that will give us an idea of where to take this, where to go from
here.
Yeah,
totally. I have some ideas. And you mentioned, if we want to keep doing these conversations, that you had also done a similar kind of analysis with was it trust and what was the other one?
And collective action.
Perfect. And so with those three components, power, trust, and collective action, you can do a lot of work.
Correct. So we look at power as an emergent phenomenon, try to find the generative function or the protocols. We look at trust networks, emergent phenomenon. Again, people try to work on the level of the emergent phenomenon, but we need to... If we see these protocols, then we're sensitive and responsive to the little micro events that will or will not build trust in society. Instead of talking about, you see, that's maybe the point of this, that we're trying to build people to be sensitive and responsible and responsive to the micro events that make a difference at the level of the emergent pattern. And then, so trust is one. Power and collective action. What do we do together? What world are we going to build?
Yeah, beautiful. I love it. I love this inquiry. It's so enlivening to me. Like, it feels so healthy.
Yeah,
good. So
and I don't think it's the whole thing. I think it's a piece.
Yeah.
And so putting it out there and getting responses, is going to get us into much richer territory.
Totally. And I feel like it's...
I really believe that.
Yeah, me too. And I think that, you know, I hope we get to live in a time where to say something like it's just a piece goes without saying. And certainly, like, I think the reason you could bring this piece is because you see that quite clearly. And so... Yeah, this is a piece, but it's also a really fucking cool piece that I am excited to explore more and kind of discover how I can leverage it in my own context to, you know, move the dial even just a tiny bit.
Yeah.
So thank you, Bonita.
This is great.
Really appreciate the conversation.
Thank you.
We'll talk again soon.
Thanks for all your work and everything that you bring to the discussion.